welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, hello. I'm Maria Zylstra here with Lingua Franca and the case for learning a language that's commonly described as dead. A local language of ancient Rome, it became the language of the Roman Empire and then the classical language of Europe, Latin. Its later usage by the Renaissance humanists, called Neo-Latin, is becoming more and more important to any proper understanding of our own culture and history, as Professor Yasmin Huskell of the University of Western Australia explains.
Those of you who've never heard the term Neo-Latin may be forgiven for thinking it's a new South American dance craze. If you're puzzled when I tell you it has something to do with the language of the Romans, take heart. Over the years, many classicists I know have confessed they're not really sure what it is either. Some have assumed it was the so-called Late Latin, written at the end of the Roman Empire. Others have supposed it must have something to do with the Middle Ages. Or perhaps it's that pseudo-Latin which my 5 and 7-year-old boys seem to have gleaned from the Harry Potter books, useful for spells and curses as they zap one another with makeshift paintbrush wands? No, in fact, Neo-Latin is more or less the same as the Latin that was written in the ancient world, classical Latin. So, what's so new about it? Neo-Latin is basically the new, or at least not very old, Latin, which began to be written in Europe from around the time of the Italian Renaissance, roughly speaking, from the 15th century, in conscious imitation of the Latin of the ancient Romans. As such, it's bound up with the Renaissance intellectual movement known as humanism, from which, ultimately, our modern concept of the humanities is derived. The Renaissance humanists were a new breed of scholars who threw themselves into learning the ancient languages, Latin and then later on Greek, recovering and translating long-lost manuscripts of the classical authors, and promoting a fashionable new programme of studies based on the ancient texts, the so-called Studia Humanitatis, grammar, poetry, rhetoric, history, and moral philosophy. Now this may not sound very new to 21st century ears, but the quiet revolution of the humanists was a determination to understand the ancients as real historical actors, as human beings who had lived full and interesting lives, lives more glamorous than ours, and not just as disembodied voices quoted out of context, as they often were in the medieval texts the humanists loved to hate. As a matter of fact, medieval Latin literature is much more multifarious, rich and sophisticated than many classicists today realise, so profoundly has our discipline been shaped by the humanist invention of the myth of the Dark Ages. But that's another story. At the root of the humanist project was a commitment to language and style, which might strike us today as pedantic. The new Latin of the humanists was strictly modelled on that of their Roman heroes, and they were always proclaiming its superiority over the university Latin lingo of the later Middle Ages, which they deemed barbaric. Why? By studying and obsessively imitating classical Latin, the humanists were straining to hear the authentic voices of the ancients over the crackle of the intervening centuries. They were reaching out to them, both literally and metaphorically, trying to speak the same language. But the term Neo-Latin is also used today in a rather looser sense to refer to just about any Latin written between the 15th and 19th centuries, and a good deal of that isn't particularly humanist or highbrow. Much of it is, in fact, pretty workaday, since, until not so long ago, Latin functioned in the West as a scientific, scholarly, and diplomatic lingua franca, much like English does today. The story is often told of Latin's battles with the vernaculars in the early modern period, a story with its climax in the 18th century, when the dusty old language, together with all sorts of outmoded and elitist ideas, was swept away by the cleansing broom of the French Enlightenment. It'd be truer to say that it was swept under the carpet. D'Alembert, mathematician, moderniser and editor with Diderot of that great monument of Enlightenment publishing, the Encyclopédie, delighted in pouring scorn on the Latin poetry that was being composed in his day. But at the same time, he conceded that Latin was an ideal medium for international scientific communication. The fact is that Latin never really went away. While many educated people may still be aware of this fact, few perhaps are aware of the vast extent of Neo-Latin literature in the early modern period. Literally thousands of documents, official and ephemeral, literary and scientific, textbooks, treatises, letters and diaries, learned journals, poems and plays, satires, and even novels remain untranslated to this day. Within the past decade, Harvard University Press has launched a new series of must-have Latin writings from the Italian Renaissance, with Latin text and English translation on facing pages. The general editor, James Hankins, writes tantalisingly of a lost continent of Neo-Latin literature, which he hopes to, quote, raise to the surface once more and allow students and scholars to explore its hidden treasures, a noble goal. But we should bear in mind that, in spite of the best efforts of Hankins and his team of scholarly marine archaeologists, bilingual book series like this can only ever salvage a fraction of what's down there. The lost continent threatens to slip even deeper into a sea of general oblivion if Latin continues to be taught, as is the case in most classics departments throughout the English-speaking world, as an exclusively ancient language. What Hankins's Atlantis metaphor perhaps obscures is the fact that the lost continent isn't somebody else's. It is, in fact, the record of our own past, which is slowly sinking under the waves. But why, I can hear you mutter, should we care so much about the pompous Latin poetry composed since the Renaissance by dead white European males? Well, first, we shouldn't assume that writing in Latin was only for dilettantes, or that Latin was reserved for works of a stuffier nature. The literary vernaculars of Italy and France grew out of Latin, struggling at first to mimic the expressive range of their more sophisticated parent. In the Renaissance, the Italian Giovanni Pontano composed lilting Latin lullabies for his children and celebrated the humble joys of married life, to say nothing of his adventures with Neapolitan prostitutes. The Frenchman Joachim du Bellay is much more personal in his Latin poetry than in his native French. And as for the English, Milton was genuinely torn between his vocations for Latin and English verse. In fact, not only was nearly every early modern schoolboy raised to appreciate Roman poetry, he was also, whether he liked it or not, a de facto Latin poet. In the 18th century Jesuit College of La Flèche in Paris, schoolboys composed Latin poems on games and sports, badminton, football, billiards, chess, snakes and ladders, and the very composing of such poems was itself a kind of competitive sport. And by the way, Latin wasn't only written by men and boys. Among the many brilliant women Latinists of the early modern period, we might single out Elizabeth Jane Weston. Westonia, as she was known, was the stepdaughter of the Irish alchemist and medium Edward Kelly, and she grew up in exile in the Prague of the arts-loving and occult-arts-loving Rudolf II. She became an accomplished poet already in her teens, and when the family fortunes turned, Kelly had fallen out of favour with the emperor and died, possibly of an overdose of his own alchemical elixir of life, Weston used Latin verse to reach a wide international audience and garner sympathy and material support. But it isn't just the writings of women providing rich new pickings for Neo-Latinists. To return to Hankins's metaphor, there are multiple lost continents of Latin still waiting to be discovered. Latin was carried around the globe by European colonists and missionaries in the early modern period, to the Americas, Africa, and Asia. A huge volume of Neo-Latin literature is concerned with New World subjects, and exciting new research is currently being conducted, for example, into Mexico's colonial Latin heritage from the 16th through 18th centuries. Indigenous Mexicans were such talented Latinists that they put many European noses out of joint. Their facility with the language led some to accuse them of possession by the devil. Indeed, Latin became the preferred language over Spanish for the expression of Mexican cultural identity. This brings me to the relevance of the study of Latin in 21st century Australia. Terra Australis was only colonised by Europeans after the suppression of the Jesuits, the crack troops of the Catholic Reformation, who carried a Latin humanist education to far-flung missions in the Americas, India, China, and Japan. If it had been Jesuits rather than Lutheran missionaries who first made contact with Australia's indigenous people, who knows, students in our high schools might now be reading Australian Neo-Latin classics about country. There is an 18th century example from South America, the Rusticatio Mexicana, or Mexican Country Life, by the Guatemala-born poet Rafael Landivar, which lovingly documents the natural history and culture of his native land. Alas, Latin in Australia still bears the taint of elitism and monoculturalism, a legacy, no doubt, of its historical association here with British Empire, privilege, and posh schools. An Italian mature-age student of mine tells me that, as a schoolgirl in Sydney after the war, she had longed to join the Latin class. Her grades in maths and science were excellent, but the headmistress flatly refused. Latin would be beyond her, apparently, because, as a native Italian speaker, her English wasn't up to it. I would like to put in a plea here for a more multicultural perspective on Latin. First, and most obviously, as the linguistic foundation of so many modern Latin languages and cultures, such as French, Italian, Spanish, and Portuguese. Secondly, as a significant literary language in early modern times, even for non-Latin cultures. Most European countries, from the Swedes to the Southern Slavs, from the Irish to the Hungarians, have a rich and extensive Neo-Latin literature. And thirdly, and this may come as something of a surprise, as a language of real historical importance in Asia. It's a paradox that much more Latin was written in and about countries like China, Japan, and India in the early modern period than in or about Australia. Many early Latin works on Asian history, natural history, medicine, linguistics, astronomy, economics, religion, even interfaith dialogue have yet to be translated or explored in detail. It could be argued, then, that Latin is indispensable not only for a proper understanding of Australia's long European history, but also for a better appreciation of the history and cultures of our region. Nearly 20 years ago, I began my own voyage of Neo-Latin discovery when I chanced on a fascinating book about the Renaissance philosopher Giordano Bruno, that bold free thinker, perhaps magician, who proclaimed an infinite universe of innumerable worlds, championed the heliocentric theory of Copernicus, thumbed his nose at the Catholic Church, and who, for his troubles, was burnt at the stake in Rome in 1600. Bruno's use of Latin poetry as a medium for his iconoclastic modern philosophy was a revelation to me. An indulgent doctoral supervisor allowed me to continue on what was then a rather eccentric path, and I've never looked back. Of course, that was in the prehistoric era BI, before the internet. In the 1980s and 90s, I can tell you it wasn't so easy to get hold of Neo-Latin texts in Australia. Today, slowly but surely, even the lost continent of Neo-Latin literature is resurfacing on the World Wide Web. Rare titles, access to which once required the purchase of expensive microfilms, overseas research trips, and carefully worded letters of introduction to librarians in French, Italian, even Latin, are now unceremoniously spat out at me while randomly Googling. Of course, English translations are rarely supplied, and it's impossible to translate it all, given the quantity of material out there. So, since it's a job too big for Babelfish, in the end, it seems, there's no substitute for learning the language. Please, let's not allow Latin to die in Australian schools and universities, thinking there is nothing new to know or write about a dead language.
Yasmin Huskell is Casamarca Foundation Associate Professor in Latin Humanism at the University of Western Australia. I'm Maria Zylstra, and you can hear Lingua Franca every week at this time here on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. all the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.